Hello and welcome to the Global Insight from Control Risks, the global specialist risk consultancy. I'm your host, Charles Hecker, bringing you clear insight every 2 weeks in an age of increasingly dynamic risk and intensifying connectivity. COVID-19 was the low probability, high risk event that many companies and business leaders were not prepared for. The implications have been extraordinarily uneven. Some businesses have been severely disrupted or even wiped out. Others have weathered the storm, and in some cases even thrived. Focused on the daily navigation of the crisis, few business leaders have considered how to prepare for the next COVID-19, whether it's another pandemic, a natural disaster spurred by climate change, or even civil unrest. Some businesses have succeeded due to a certain amount of circumstance and suitability. Tech, for example, is very well suited to a socially distanced world. But circumstance and suitability are not a strategy. As uncertainty becomes a constant companion for global business, agility in the face of unpredictable risk is much more than a contingency plan. It's a competitive advantage. Here to tell us why is a panel of experts who I have the great pleasure of calling colleagues. Claudine Frye is a London-based director of our Global Risk Analysis Division. Among other things, Claudine was once the company's Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst. Hi, Claudine.
Hi, Chuck.
Matt Hinton is a New York-based partner in the firm and one of the leaders of our crisis and security consultancy in the Americas. Matt, nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
Allison Wood is based in Houston, where she's an associate director in global risk analysis. Allison manages our political risk consultancy in the U.S. and was previously a senior member of our team in Dubai. Allison, hi.
Hi, Chuck.
Let's start with the question of how companies have been responding to the current crisis and how they might be improving their response either to this one or to the next one. Matt, in New York, companies must be absolutely exhausted from the COVID crisis and the COVID response, but there's no rest for the weary, is there? In your conversations with clients, Matt, have you even been able to raise the topic of the next crisis? And where you do, what is that conversation like?
The reality is, for a lot of clients, they're already dealing with or have recently dealt with their next crisis. And that's what's quite interesting. So you think about the wildfires, you think about the hurricanes, you think about the civil unrest, think about cyber attacks, you think about workplace violence events. All of these things continue to happen in the midst of the world of COVID, right? As we always like to say, crises are not polite. Now, for many of our clients, they are asking that question around, okay, we know there's a second or third wave coming. We know these other crises are going to come down the pipe. What do we need to do? What should we be thinking about? And there's a wide variety of answers there as to what companies can focus on. But one of the biggest things that I believe is key to their success is going to be self-reflection, right? So in the world of crisis management and business continuity, there's something called a post-incident review or a lessons learned review that you often do at the end of a crisis. But the reality is that this crisis is so long and so devastating, you don't have time to wait. And so you need to do it now. And you need to look at how you've responded to date and figure out how do we optimize that response going forward.
So a company can have a plan, a company can review its plan and also benefit from lessons learned. But companies don't exist in a vacuum. Allison and Claudine, both of you have been following the pandemic globally. And Allison, you've had an added focus on the US. What does your geopolitical location have to do with your crisis response? Where does it get easier? Where does it get harder? What are the main factors determining that element?
Well, you know, Chuck, I think companies with a global presence had an initial advantage in this crisis. I remember speaking to colleagues back in Asia in February who were in that bewildered first phase of lockdown and who were then able to help us get through our own lockdown difficulties a few months later, how to manage your day, how to manage kids at home, etc. And our clients were benefiting from that too. We were able to share our own learnings on managing office shutdowns, transitioning projects, managing people. But these same global operators are now stuck with managing multiple phases of a pandemic crisis simultaneously long term. And as you said earlier, they must be exhausted. We all are, right? For a protracted period, global companies need to get on top of an enormous amount of localized data to adjust their policies and operating practices to fit the COVID circumstances of many, sometimes hundreds, of different operating environments. This is a huge commitment of resources to doing this effectively. And so companies that are able to either have in-house teams doing this or source the expertise externally are finding that they're in a much better place, much better position to be reacting in a timely fashion to changes on the ground. But global companies also face a particular challenge in ensuring that their communication, their culture, and their priorities are meaningful at any one time to colleagues who are living their lives with commutes, office life, and kids in school, as in Shanghai now, for example, and those who are stuck in very difficult circumstances with lockdowns or in areas with endemic COVID, who have no prospect of travel, face-to-face team meetings, or team time for an indefinite period.
Allison, you've been sitting for quite some time in one of the epicenters of the pandemic in the United States. In your conversations with clients, does their perspective from the U.S., their location in the U.S., has this changed how they look at the pandemic or how they respond to it?
I think a lot of the points that Claudine made hold true for clients in the US as well. Many companies here are, of course, multinationals, and many have a significant presence or a significant part of their supply chain in Asia. And I think these were the first companies to really key into what was happening with coronavirus and start to more rigorously monitor the situation, stand up crisis management teams, put more concrete, I guess, monitoring in place and start to plan for what might happen in other markets. As the crisis began to hit full force in Europe, I think more companies jumped on this bandwagon. They started to, I don't want to say panic, but scramble to pull together teams and respond and consider how this might play out once the virus jumped the Atlantic. Of course, by that point, it really already had, but I don't think people necessarily fully realized that at that point. And then I do, though, think that there are two points that are interesting about the way the crisis played out here. The impact of the virus in the initial weeks and months was really concentrated in a couple of epicenters in the country, New York and, you know, arguably Seattle. And while this isn't unique, you know, other countries also saw this phenomenon. I do think because of the sheer size of the US, I think it created a false sense of security for many people because they didn't feel like they had personally been affected by the virus, aside from having to stay home for a certain period of time. And so I think this kind of contributed to politicians feeling pressure to reopen economies. We then, of course, saw a much more significant wave of cases in June and July after state economies reopened. We saw this across a much larger number of hotspots that until that point had really been relatively unaffected. And so that period is really where we saw sort of the full force of the virus, I guess, hit the U.S. I do, though, think the other thing that's been interesting about the way the crisis has played out here is really just the localization of regulations or advisories. We have 50 states, and within the states, you have counties and cities, each of which are coming out with their own, advisories in many cases about how they expect businesses to operate under certain circumstances. And this has just been really challenging, I think, for businesses to grapple with. It's a lot of information to keep track of. It's not centralized. So to kind of develop a strategy with how to deal with that and make sure employees aren't confused has been challenging. And I think that comes back to a point that Matt made earlier, which is that this has forced companies in many cases to reevaluate their overall process for dealing with issues like this. How do they not just collect information, but process it and have it actively feed into decisions and policies that are meaningful for the business?
Just to add to what Allison was saying, I think it's really interesting to reflect on how the status and role of risk committees, crisis management committees within companies has evolved during the course of this crisis. Matt pointed out they're actually often dealing with multiple crises at any one time, and they have now got a status which perhaps wasn't the case before. And in many cases, they are initiating reviews of how companies will better anticipate and deal with the consequences of crises in the future. And we're seeing a lot of members of organizations taking on very different responsibilities to the ones that they had before the crisis. In many cases, this will make companies better able to respond effectively in the future.
Matt, before we move on to another question, I just want to come back to you for a second. The array of crises that companies are managing or juggling all at the same time is really pretty impressive. But when you're writing crisis management plans. When you're taking a company through a crisis like this, there's a critical part of the business in China, there's a critical part of the business in India, there's a critical part of the business in Mexico. How do you weave that in?
When we talk about crisis management done right and building governance structures, it's all about delegation of authority and setting clear parameters around who is responding to what when. And so having a very clear understanding of who is responsible at a local, regional, and kind of group or corporate level is incredibly important. And we saw instances during COVID where this really didn't work well and it caused massive issues. So I'll give you one example is around communications. So you would have somebody at corporate putting out a plan around, let's say, work from home, but somebody in a particular region having their own views on it and putting it out to their employees specifically. And now the employees are getting two different viewpoints on a very important part of their work environment and are not sure what they're supposed to believe in, right? So getting that delegation of authority, getting those roles and responsibilities right and agreed upon ahead of a crisis, ideally, is incredibly important to making that as fluid as possible.
Let's move on to something that readers of The Economist magazine will have seen recently. The Economist used or coined the term Frankenfirm for companies that need to fragment themselves to operate in different jurisdictions all around the world due to the rise of nationalism and protectionism. To what degree, maybe this is a question for Allison and Claudine, to what degree should companies be concerned about nationalist moves like this? And what's the implication for the way future crises are handled?
Chuck, I read that piece in The Economist with great interest. And of course, it notes that it's certainly not a new phenomenon. And indeed, it's a trend that we identified pre-COVID. It's one of many geopolitical issues facing companies, which has been brought into much sharper focus by COVID. Nationalism is definitely something we expect to be on the rise in the aftermath of this pandemic. It is an unfortunate reality of the times that we're living in, that there really is no meaningful international cooperation, will, or capacity to pursue joined up solutions to manage crises across borders. So for companies, they have to operate with an awareness of an extraordinarily complex geopolitical environment characterized by states acting generally in their own national interest, and working on the assumption that they will need to navigate through crises in a geopolitical leadership vacuum.
Just to build on what Claudine said, this trend towards nationalism will, I think, have very real implications for companies, not only in crisis scenarios, but also in ways that are perhaps more banal, but equally more durable, I would say. As economies come under strain, we expect to see governments increasingly held to account on what they are doing to improve their country's economic position. And the reality of that is, under this broader macro trend towards nationalism, policies that clearly protect local jobs, local companies, local industries will, in most cases, win more popular support and will win out over things like multilateral trade deals or complex fiscal and monetary policies. Now, these may eventually be just as beneficial in economic terms, but they don't have that same feel-good factor of cutting ribbon at a new factory with 500 new jobs, or being able to say that, you know, 800 new companies have been established in your state in the past quarter. These are the types of things that, you know, have the potential to win over a public. Now, what will this mean for companies in practical terms? Policies may incentivize or require onshoring of supply chains. Here in the US, where we've seen both candidates promise to shift production of medical equipment and other key pandemic products back to the US, policies may require or incentivize the use of local companies and supply chains. We see this quite a bit in the extractive sector and infrastructure already. Data protection and sort of onshoring of data storage is something that we might see to sort of bolster tech industries in local areas. And then finally, requirements or protections for local workers, ensuring that foreign companies hire local employees, or conversely, tightening immigration or work visa policies is another thing that we expect to see over the coming months. Keep in mind that governments will, I think, seek to balance these protectionist policies with still remaining open to or incentivizing foreign investment. But as Claudine said, this fracturing of multilateral cooperation combined with turning inward will force companies to rethink corporate structures, supply chains, and how they position or present themselves in certain markets. And these types of decisions have implications for years to come.
Claudine, since you actually read the article, have you heard the expression Frankenfirm before, or is this something that The Economist is taking credit for actually coining as a new phrase?
Chuck, I haven't come across it before.
This notion of a sort of zombie firm that's been stitched together strikes me as a little bit scary for the future, but let's see how much it gains currency. Speaking of the future, at the very top of the podcast, we called the coronavirus pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, a low probability, high impact event. Does that mean that companies can just sort of write this one off as a once in a century shock to the system? Or will there genuinely be other crises of this magnitude, of this duration, and of this depth? Matt, what are you thinking?
We get asked this question a lot. Is this going to be something that we need to change everything that we do because of this one-time event? Or is this something we're going to deal with going forward? The answer I've been giving a lot is this might not even be the most deadly communicable disease we deal with over the next 20 to 30 years, not to mention all the other crisis types that are still going to be out there and companies are still going to need to deal with. It's causing, in my opinion, issues in terms of readiness for these future events because people have almost this false sense of security because they've somehow managed to get through this event. They now think they can get through anything. And the reality is all of these different types of crises have different types of impacts. And whether it's as wide or as big as COVID, crises are not going to stop in the future. And so companies still need to prepare and still stick with their basics around governance, around planning, around exercising, getting that muscle memory ready for whatever they can do.
I want to pose a question to my political risk colleagues just for a moment. It sort of sets my teeth on edge when I hear people refer to the COVID-19 pandemic as a black swan, you know, one of those unknown unknowns or an incident that was impossible to forecast or predict. Allison and Claudine, do you feel the same way about the way this crisis is sometimes described?
I mean, I have a very distinct memory of doing a, I guess, enterprise risk management project for a client based in Dubai back in, I think, 2014 it was. And we had actually put a pandemic on their risk register. They had a lot of different investments across a number of different sectors, some of which included retail, specifically in malls. And we put this on there and it was sort of almost immediately discounted by their senior management as something that was so unlikely. It was something that they didn't need to plan for, right? I guess I've sort of looked back on that experience now, you know, 5 or 6 years later and saying, well, I mean, we did tell you that this is something you should think about. So in that sense, I don't think it's a black swan. This is something that we've always known. History has told us that these come around every so often, and it's something that we should be prepared for. But I don't think it fell very high on the priority of many organizations because it was seen as this low probability event, right? And I think that does speak to, I think, the value really of doing exercises like risk registers and brainstorming sort of enterprise risks to your business. Because what's been unique about this crisis, right, is that there was a point at which it sort of hit the whole world at the same time. And I do think that that is very unusual, right? But the idea that organizations are not going to have, you know, a similar crisis with the same level of impact on their business, it's not going to be a black swan in that sense. But what is important is for you as an organization to understand what are those events that could have this type of impact on your business. And for some, it will be centered around, you know, maybe US-China relations. For others, it will be security dynamics in India. But you as an organization have to figure that out and decide sort of what are your black swans, at which point sort of that term becomes meaningless.
You know, the other thing to be incorporating into those conversations is thinking about what the impact will be should any of these events that you identify occur, right? So this is obviously a very emotive time. And there's a whole load of theories out there about the pandemic and its significance and who is responsible and what kind of civil liberties should be curtailed as we fight it and so on. But really, for companies, what matters is thinking about the impact on their people, on their markets, on their premises, on their brand, really regardless of how we classified the crisis from a theoretical perspective. And, you know, I have some sympathy with people who want to describe it as a black swan. I mean, after all, it has had a major effect. And, you know, it was fairly surprising.
One other thing that's interesting with the black swan label is I think a lot of companies are attaching that black swan label to this event almost as an excuse for why they were not prepared. And that's not surprising because, you know, as both Claudine and Allison have said, we work with companies in the enterprise risk management space. those events that are, or those risks rather, that kind of get classified as low probability, high impact, get shoved to the side under this idea that that'll never happen to us. But I think COVID has actually shown us that, you know, the improbable is not unfathomable anymore, right? And we need to take these things seriously and be attacking them. The other thing that I think is an interesting aspect to this, so a lot of companies don't have pandemic plans. They might have a crisis management plan. They might have a business continuity plan. They don't have a pandemic plan. Even those that did have them, most of them did not account for an overnight global shelter-in-place scenario. So the plans were almost instantaneously not useful. And so I think that added to the complication and the response here as well. So even if they said, hey, we're taking this seriously, hey, we're building a plan around it, the assumptions themselves were fundamentally flawed to begin with, and that put them on their back foot.
You know, is there really a historical analog to what the world is experiencing right now? I mean, how can we view the context for business from a broader viewpoint?
I do think it's important to put the pandemic into perspective. The world has been through pandemics in the past, and indeed, it's fascinating to reflect on the way that London was managing the plague in the 1600s in ways that are remarkably similar to the way that we're fighting COVID-19 now. So, for example, there was a practice of social distancing. There was also the isolation of sick people. I think the COVID-19 pandemic has also highlighted how very misplaced that idea was at the end of the Cold War, that we'd perhaps reached the end of history. You know, clearly we're heading into some pretty choppy times. We do expect geopolitical tensions to be increasing in the coming years. That's evident already, for example, with the state of the US-China relationship, with the weakening that we're seeing of international organizations. And so it's really a time for companies to be putting the monitoring and understanding of political and geopolitical risks right back up to the top of their priority list. But from an optimistic perspective, I would also like to share that I hope this period of time is one that ultimately, for all its challenges, is seen as one that precipitates progress. And so for companies and for us as individuals, it's a period of time that led to advances in the ways that we live, in the ways that we consume, that we educate, that we sell, and in the way that we manage risk.
I think here in the US, it certainly feels like a pretty significant historic moment, not just because of the pandemic, but because sort of the wave of social unrest that we've seen really since May here in the US, and with one of the most, I think, contested, and certainly the media is putting it in very historic terms, presidential elections coming up in November, people really do have the sense that 2020 is a year of exception. But I do think that a lot of the issues and themes that we're dealing with, the underlying sort of structural drivers of a lot of these things were already there prior to the pandemic. What we've seen the pandemic do, though, is accelerate or exacerbate certain drivers or issues in ways that we were not expecting. And so I think sort of understanding that helps us to see at least a couple months into the future. Although I think, you know, the task of figuring out what's going to happen in 2021 is one that I think we're all sort of apprehensive of at this point.
So what we're going to do is in 2021, we're going to get this same crowd together, and we're going to go back and have a look at all of the things that we said today. And then we're going to have a little bit of an outlook on the future and examine historical context one more time. Before we close out, I'd just like to say a very quick thank you to all of my panelists today. Matt Hinton, dialing in from New York, a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Chuck. Thanks for having me.
Allison, thank you very, very much for calling in from Houston.
Of course, anytime.
And Claudine, not too far away in London. Great to hear from you.
Thanks so much for having me, Chuck.
Stay updated with new episodes of The Global Insight every other week by subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. And be sure to check out our other podcasts as well, such as Legal and Compliance Insights, a monthly podcast that gives you a window onto the legal and compliance issues our experts are facing around the world. You can follow all of our analysis and find out how we're helping businesses build organizations that are secure, compliant, and resilient by visiting controlrisks.com. Thank you. And goodbye for now.